once you had a glimpse, there's no way to go back. Raise yourself, it's because you go forever on the neck. Forever on the neck.
Hi there, how's everyone doing? That was our show's theme by Johnny Lancia. I am your host, Daniel Kurland, with you for another installment of Bic Zuko's Forever Almanac, a chronicle of reminiscences. I was at Central Park the other day and overheard a group of maybe 8 children of mixed gender, not the children themselves, but collectively as a group, their genders were mixed. They formed enough of a representative sample is what I mean. The children were discussing magic is what is important, or rather the lack of magic these days. Sure, they conceded that magic existed in some flashy sense, but they seemed much more impressed with the magic of television and iPhones and Channing Tatum's stomach and Katy Perry's above stomach. None of them believed in magic in the true sense of the word. And that reminds me of this related story that I found in the Forever Almanac. Let me read it for you. It's called Wismer's Wand. Wismer's Wand. Today was not an easy day. It was a have a drink to restore balance to the world and then have another 2 more kind of day. I'd gotten notes back on the 8th book in the Adventwestrian series, and it seems there are going to be more than a few issues with me pairing up Cody and Ben. Not because they're both male, but because one morphs into a black horse and the other a white one. Such a ridiculous time that we live in. But I found myself back at Houtini's knocking them back. Houtini's was a magician bar, the name itself being an amalgamation of the words Houdini and Martini. But I myself was not yet a magician. It was still years until that chapter of my life. This bar was merely close to my home, and a close bar is a much greater trick than any hat rabbit or sleeve kerchief. So I was often drinking there. The crowd was always friendly enough, so when a sad-looking gray of a man offered to buy my next round, it didn't strike me as unusual. The man said his name was Wismer, and when I made contact with his piercing aquamarine eyes, I felt an uneasiness sweep under me and enter my lungs, finding myself unable to return to or even remember whatever I was thinking about previously, but now rather focused only on Wismer. Entirely on Wismer, needing to hear his story and learn about his life. And I may not have even asked him. Words might have simply started coming out of his mouth, words that it didn't sound like Wismer was happy to share with me, but words that were said because he knew I needed to hear them. And hear them I did. Wismer would do a free magic show every week for the children at the public library. Wismer adored this. It was everything to him. It gave the magician such great satisfaction, fascinating the children and keeping the want and desire for magic alive. But even more importantly, keeping imagination ripe in the minds of the young. What is life without magic? Merely the cold annals of a records department, Wismer would often shout, referring back to his passionless days cooped up in the basement of the city records department, filing away traffic infractions. It was very clear that magic was what pumped the blood through Wismer's body and kept him alive, and not the work of the pulmonary system of the heart. Sundays at the library continued to run smoothly until a young boy named Daniel showed up. In fact, that might not be accurate. This might not have been the first time that Daniel attended Wismer's magic show. He might have been there for weeks, sitting in silence, ingesting the content, but this was the first week that Daniel made his presence known. And he did this with a heckle. It started very simple for Daniel, merely laughing or talking over Wismer as he did his act. Sure, it was distracting, but Wismer would keep entertaining. The faintest lines of concern brewing around his mouth and the most transparent furrows of confusion forming on his brow, but that was all. As the weeks continued, Daniel's behavior only worsened. He would yell out false secrets to true illusions and complain that he could see the strings behind the tricks. "There are no strings," Wismer would insist. "Come and see for yourself." "Thanks, but no thanks, dude," Daniel would shout back, and the crowd of children would respond in laughter so loud you'd question if you were even in a library. While Wismer's concern lines grew deeper and his brow furrows became a more central feature of his face, Daniel was still just a mild blemish on what was otherwise the highlight of Wismer's week. He even made little wizard hats for the children to wear during the show. You see, Wismer lived alone with no family, and the women he would occasionally see on dates would never stay. They were not repulsed by Wismer's appearance, for he was an average-looking man, above average by some standards even. And they were not deterred by his hygiene, for Wismer bathed and maintained his cleanliness that of which the average man did, some would even say above average. And they were not even turned off by Wismer's personality, for he had as many anecdotes and things to say as the average man did, perhaps even more. No, the fact of the matter was that Wismer was just too regular for people. Not exciting or boring enough to garner any remembrance, and because of this, Wismer was alone. Except on Sundays, when he had his magic and the children that loved it so. Naturally, the constant gluing and cutting and assembling of hats left Wismer's hands calloused and worn, and while it made his tricks less nimble and his hands less slight, they still continued. Eventually, young Daniel's heckles and squeals for attention became too much. Week after week, it seemed like the show was becoming more about the quips Daniel would yell and less about whimsy and the fantastical. And then one week, he was gone. Wismer didn't appear. "Where is Wismer?" the concerned parents asked. "It's 2 o'clock. Shouldn't the weekly magic show be going on?" But all the sympathetic librarian could do was shrug her osteoporosis-ridden shoulders and meekly say, "Perhaps he's just late. He must just be late." But he never came. Paper wizard hats littered the parking lot. Sure, the children got over it. Their parents took them out for ice cream and peanut brittle, or a trip to the petting zoo, and no one's lives seemed to be much different in the end. Paper wizard hats were traded for cavities and pin-on tiger tails, and the world kept on turning. Daniel didn't make it a habit of going to the library after Wismer left, but one day he needed a book on ecosystems for a school report. The school report was on ecosystems. Upon checking out the book, the librarian asked the 12-year-old, "Daniel Gans? You're Daniel Gans?" "That's what it says on my underwear," the obnoxious boy squawked out and proceeded to pull his pants down, revealing a wealth of stains both foreign and domestic. "Oh my word, what a display!" The librarian whimpered out, much to Daniel's delight. And without hesitation, she set a small box down in front of the boy. "Wismer left you this. He died," she said. Daniel opened the box, and in it was a neatly printed note that said, "This is for you. You need it the most." And underneath it was an old wooden magic wand about 14 inches in length. Wismer's magic wand. Pieces of white paint flecked off from the ends, revealing the plain wood underneath. He had left it to the boy that ruined his performances and mocked his trade. He had left the future of the Wismer name with a petulant child who didn't even realize that he needed magic and hope and the gift of the impossible more than anyone else in that audience. That this boy had all the potential to be the eventual Wismer II, and that perhaps he and the original had walked parallel paths in their youth. Daniel then held the wand in his hand for the first time and felt a surge run through him. A surge of responsibility and maturity coalescing throughout his body, pushing him forward, as if Wismer himself was holding his hand and taking those steps with him. Things were now going to be okay. Daniel left the library, eyes widened with the prospect of renewal. He calmly walked through the parking lot, taking in nature as it came to him, finally appreciating and respecting what had been around him for so long. And then, and only then, did he take out Wismer's wand. His body now finely attuned with the environment. Daniel gingerly wove the wand and chanted the magic words that he heard Wismer repeat every week, hoping that his first spell would come to fruition. And would you know what that spell was for? That there would be more marigolds in the parking lot. Yes, it certainly seemed like Daniel had changed. Only none of this was true. He hadn't changed in the slightest. Because when Daniel grabbed that wand, he felt nothing at all. He callously took Wismer's wand out of the box it came in and tucked it into his pants waist. He then held out the precious box with both arms, squinted his eyes, and with a devilish grin, dropkicked the box, bellowing, "Fuck, shit, fuck," as his foot connected with it. The novelty of swearing for the sake of swearing had not worn thin on Daniel yet. The box proceeded to connect with the car's window, cracking it. But Daniel didn't notice or care about this. Daniel continued running into the streets, holding the wand with outstretched arms, dragging it across the many cars parked along the sidewalk. Soon all the cars had magic tricks coating their sides. This apparently was only the opening act of Daniel's routine, as he marched to the gardens of the houses, whacking his wand at the flowers, beheading each of them, his illusions and trickery transforming all of the flower patches on the block. Still unsatisfied with the powers of the wand, he concluded with his big closing number, throwing the wand at the oncoming spokes of oncoming bikes, using magic to stop motion in its very tracks. Daniel would never connect with his throws, but he'd end up distracting the riders enough to divert them on their paths, sometimes even fall, which was good enough for Daniel. He picked up the wand from one of his many hurls, it steadily becoming more scuffed and weathered, the prized possession of one becoming a mere accomplice in mischief to another. A girl a few years older than Daniel saw him throwing the wand at the bicyclist and approached him. She said that one of the bikers was her grody stepbrother, and that she thought that what he was doing was really cool. That he was really cool. The girl wasn't much to look at, her hair was stringy and gathered in knots at the end, and her aquamarine eyes felt lost in the forest of her face. She wore a tight pink tank top and had on matching sweatpants that brandished the word moist on the back. She took Daniel by the hand and led him into a filthy car by the sidewalk that he assumed must have belonged to her family. Once inside, the girl-like creature just started taking off her clothes apathetically, like it was the most natural thing in the world. Daniel had no experience in this area and didn't know what to do, where to begin, and was distracted by the strong scent of bubblegum that covered the girl. It was overwhelming. Did she make soap out of bubblegum? Did she bathe in the stuff? But fortunately, the girl's pudgy hands grabbed his own and communal pong started to take place. Small instruments of flesh slapping others, the wet schlocking sound of meat hitting meat hitting meat, bouncing off the walls of the cramped car. The girl was unsatisfied though, vehemently so. She kept braying for more and more, so Daniel put Wismer's wand to use, and soon it connected him and the girl. This weird flesh and wood hybrid that bucked and trembled like a fawn taking its first steps. This piece of magical wood sliding in and out of her, collecting layers of film and meniscus to its already seasoned veneer. Tiny slivers that had amused children and saved rainy days breaking off and lodging themselves in the girl's canal. Daniel kept working the wand as if he was trying to pull off the most elaborate trick in the world, and that the girl was his assistant, both working together to successfully make magic. Then the girl let out a moan, tightened around the wand, kissed Daniel on the lips, and pushed him out of the vehicle. All that he could concentrate on was the overwhelming taste of bubblegum that filled his mouth and climbed down his throat. He spit on the ground and was surprised when it didn't come out pink. Daniel tried to get his mind off the things he had seen, so he went to the corner store to buy some candy. He tried to pawn off the wand on the shopkeeper in exchange for the sweets, but upon inspecting the now slimy hunk of wood, the shopkeeper shook his head, his piercing aquamarine eyes trying to instill justice in Daniel as he told him that he'd require actual money for his purchases. Daniel scrounged up enough change from his pockets for the candy, but told the shopkeeper that he was still 15 cents short, knowing there'd be no repercussions. He left the store greedily munching from his bag of loot. Daniel ended up in an alley and sat down on the cool ground, taking a rest from his sugar binging. His stomach hurt, he didn't know what from, but decided that now was as good a time as any for a rest. He set his bag of sweets down and took out Wismer's wand once more, looking it over. Out of the corner of his eye, Daniel noticed a small rat's tail sticking out of the end of his bag, chewing on something that was not theirs, and eventually poking their rat face out, strands of bubblegum caught within its whiskers, an almost playful tableau of curiosity painted before Daniel. Then, there was the briefest of squeals, and the rat's head split in half. Daniel brought the magic wand down on the intruder again, stronger the second time around. Not out of anger or violence, but because the creature had surprised the boy and had something that was his. And then he did it again, and again, and continued doing it. The rat's body a pile of hair and teeth and contorted limbs at this point, but Daniel kept smashing the wand down on him, his candy safety no longer a concern, wooden fragments flying throughout the alley until all that was left was a tiny pool of broken wood and viscera. Daniel breathed hard in the alley by himself, harder than when he was with Miss Moist, his lungs burning with every inhale, the disturbing monument by Daniel's feet being all that remained of the magic wand. The display, in fact, being much more ironic than the boy could even realize. For there is a proper ritual known as a broken wand ceremony that is conducted at the funeral of a magician, where their wand is broken to symbolize the loss of magic power. It's a popular custom that's been carried out since 1926 by the Society of American Magicians. But where is the irony? Well, After hearing this story, you may have been left wondering, how did Wismer know about the misuse of his wand and everything that Daniel was doing with it? For he was the girl, and the shopkeeper, and yes, more than likely, even the dead rat itself. He was a magician, of course, and they can take many forms. His body now scattered amongst the wand shards and the ultimate broken wand ceremony. After Daniel had caught his breath, he reached for his bag of candy, but upon seeing the gum that was inside, decided to leave it instead. While the contents of the bag were feet away from him, he was positive that he could still smell the stench of the bubblegum, reminding him of the girl in his afternoon, and Daniel began to dry heave just at the thought of eating the pink stuff ever again. Daniel hoisted himself up from the ground of the alley, wiping his filthy hands on his pants. A stain he doesn't care about that someone else will toil over as he headed home to play video games, or spam message boards, or eat dessert before dinner. He thought they were having chocolate cake that night. As I left Houtini's, Wismer's story kept sloshing through my brain. I tried to forget it and move on, but there it would be, stuck to the footprints of my other ideas, pieces of his story getting lodged in the heel of my other thoughts. It was clear that this man's tale had had an impact on me, and that impact was reducible to a single question. Is there still magic in the world? Wismer seemed convinced that there wasn't, which is why I became so determined to prove that there was. So that his story, so that his life, wasn't in vain. If that young boy wouldn't accept the responsibility of being Wismer II, then I would. I would do it despite my bile towards the frivolous trick. The show I put on was by no means an incredible show, and make no mistake, no considerable time from my existing writing schedule was sacrificed to make time for this magic. No, I simply put on an average enough magic show to remind children that magic was very real and alive today and could compete with the modern text message or digital video disc. And while it may have been fitting to perform the show at the local library, my thoughts on phantasms are well known at this point. I said to myself, it's one thing to restore a child's lost faith in magic, Bic, but it's not your place to teach them the birds and the bees of the spirit world. So accordingly, the performance was conducted at Symington Park. The tricks were going off well enough, but just because they came easily to me did not mean that I had any passion for them. The children clapped at the right times, gasped at the gasp breaks, and no Daniel Gans felt the need to make themselves known. I may have been disgusted with myself as my body was put through the throes of magic, but at least I had proven to myself that magic was still alive and had a place in this world. But then I saw it. I almost didn't. The two of them were so far back and hidden enough by shrubbery that to miss them wouldn't be unexpected. But no, they were there. And I knew they were there. She was a woman named Nicole. I had gone out with her a few times. They were nice. She was nice. And while we were far from dating, certain emotional goalposts had been met and certain obligations were expected of one another at this point. I didn't know who the man she was with was, this stranger, but it was more than clear from the position that they were in that she was sucking his cock. My Nicole. The same Nicole that told me she hated sucking cock and hated parks. And here she was doing both of those truths pretty flagrantly. And right in the midst of my wholesome magic-loving children, too. As my hands kept multiplying cards and disappearing handkerchiefs, my eyes bored deeper and deeper into the couple's outline on the horizon, as if I was trying to multiply her selfishness and make the stranger disappear. But I continued. Like a professional, I continued. My grip perhaps tighter than it should have been, and my body stiffer than usual, but otherwise my performance did not suffer, and the children were none the wiser. Yet none of the tricks I was doing seemed to be anywhere near as impressive as the magic Nicole's mouth was doing. I was furious. I was unfocused. But they almost seemed to be finished, and once they were finished, I could just get this over with. As Nicole's tempo quickened, chinks in my armor began to show. Sweat on my brow, a card fumbled here and there, but I was getting through it. Four tricks left to do. Nicole's head bobbed hungrily. Three tricks left to do. The stranger's mean hands did unseen mean things to Nicole's body. Two tricks left to do. The liars quickened and finished. At long last. One trick left to do, and then the stranger sunk below the bush. Nicole got on top of him, and she started to ride. You bare-backing cunt. I said this out loud. I said, you bare-backing cunt in front of a dozen and change 7 to 11-year-olds. A few looked up in confusion. A few more looked sad, detecting that something was wrong. But then I added, Iliosis. And again, I repeated the slanderous hate that I spit out, but disguised as a spell. You bar back into Contiliosis. You bar back into Contiliosis. I said it again. They bought it. Everything was fine. I squinted hard enough with my left eye so as to knock my contact lens out. A blurred Nicole and Stranger continued their act as I began to conclude my own. I finished my performance and took a filthy bow. The kids cheered, but I knew better. I knew that magic was dead. And that's the end. Wow, what a powerful story, right? And so I ask you this, have things really changed since then? Does magic still hold any power over us, or is it now just a lost art reserved for the dregs and forgottens, like cribbage? And what does that mean for the rest of us in our future? There's also a little footnote at the end of the story here by Bixuko that I didn't notice. It says, for those of you wondering how Wismer could have been telling me this story at the bar when Daniel had previously killed him when he was in rat form, the answer is magic. It was magic in its purest form, and if you didn't get that, then you should reread the story. Interesting. Super interesting. Anyways, there's some crude notes here that kind of indicate where Houtini's might be located, so I'm going to see if I can find that, and until next time, the Chronicle is chroniclosed.
Forever almanac.